Hi, I'm Graham Aubrey. You're listening to Resonance FM. Cause you're with it. Cause you're with it. No, I've taken it too far now.
Taken it too far.
Imagine me what I'm like when I drink beer.
Welcome to the bike show here on Resonance 104.4 FM. My name is Jack Thurston. And if you were listening to the show last week, you will have heard engineer and bicycle inventor extraordinaire Mike Burrows talking about his own very unique contribution towards the quest for a better bicycle. Well, this week we'll be hearing the concluding part of that interview. And the focus of our conversation is the laid-back bicycle, or recumbent, for which Mike is a fervent evangelist. Last week, Mike said that it was aerodynamics that meant that there was an inescapable logic to the laid-back bicycle. And I think it's worth replaying his explanation of why exactly that is.
There's a resistance to everything, okay? So when you start pedaling a bicycle, you are pushing the air out of the way, you are turning lots of little bearings around inside, and you're squashing the tyres at the bottom. But 30 mile an hour with no wind and no hill, 90% of your resistance, roughly, is aerodynamic drag, because you and your bicycle are a very bad shape, okay? You're not evolved from an albatross, but from a monkey or something like a monkey. Rolling resistance is the next thing, roughly 7%, and total mechanical drag of all the little wiggly bits that go around is about 3%. Now, as you go faster, the resistance increases, but mechanical resistance and rolling resistance rise linear. So in other words, if you double your speed, there's twice as much rolling resistance, twice as much mechanical drag. Air resistance doesn't do this. Now, air resistance goes up by the square. So if you go twice as fast, you will have four times as much air resistance. And it's even worse because the energy required to overcome it goes up by the cube. So to go twice as fast, eight times the power. Now, you can experience this any time you like. You ride into a headwind. It feels like a brick wall. It is a brick wall. You're not going to do anything about it at all other than getting inside a streamlined enclosure. That's it.
That was Mike Burrows explaining why he started thinking about laid-back bicycles. But of course, they'd been around for a long time, and Mike says that the widely accepted father of the recumbent was the Frenchman Charles Mochet, who was building them way back in the 1930s and 1940s. And at that time, he was marketing them as kind of pedal-powered cars, a little bit like the vehicles that you might have seen in the film Bugsy Malone. Anyway, I'll let Mike take up the story.
Charles Mochet, who was building pedal cars at the time. He was actually building two-seater, side-by-side, wooden-bodied bicycle component pedal cars as cheap transport in France. After the First World War, he started. Yeah, real cars were very expensive. They literally were practical machines. And he wanted a way to promote them. And the velodrome was the big thing then. The world cycle racing went on velodromes. The four-wheelers wouldn't work on velodrome. So they built a two-wheel version of the car, a laid-back bicycle. They built that, broke, sort of set a new air record with the UCI's permission. There's no streamlining on it. It was simply a laid-back. They got a good rider, but not a world record class rider. Set a new air record, which of course eventually the UCI went back on its word and banned it. Most people take this as that stopped the recumbent in its tracks, but it didn't, in fact, because he produced estimates vary between 300 and 600 bikes before Mr. Hitler put an end to his, because this was in the 30s, and he never picked up again. I mean, there was a couple of people sort of at the time tried Freddie Grubb, I think, in this country built one or two, whatever, and I suspect at the time the reason they didn't really catch on, having seen a few of the Mochet machines, the technology wasn't there. The rear gears and things, the very long chains you know, do need better control than the old-fashioned derailleurs would ever give them, and the modern materials for the frame weight and things. So I think they were sort of ahead of their time then, but he is the father of the movement. But then the modern movement started California, 1970s, Chester Kyle and co., who, never having realised this had ever happened before, because they are a bit cut off over there on the other side of the Atlantic ever since that unfortunate incident in Boston, they built streamlined bicycles. And look, don't they go fast? And of course they were told, yes, stop doing it and go away. And they said, no, okay, we won't call them bicycles, we'll call them human-powered vehicles. And we had a movement, and that was that sort of thing. I mean, it hasn't looked back, and it's now mainstream, in effect.
Why do you think it happened there and then in California?
The time and place, at the same time the mountain bike was happening, you know, Gary and the gang playing in Marin County, whatever sort of thing, all of this stuff was going on. We helped enormously. Peter Selby, a UK promoter, saw this going on and arranged for the first international event, in effect, at Brighton in 1980. Even though Freddie Laker was running the SkyTrain then, fly the American machines across, which gave it a really big kickstart.
Do you think that the oil crisis of the 1970s and concerns about the future viability of the motor car were part of that milieu of ideas?
Not at that time, no. The Americans were purely out, it was science. It was sort of, you know, fancy machines in cotton wool lined boxes breaking records and nothing else at all. We turned it into a sport, you know, partly through the Speedy and these little sort of round the house races that we started running for them. The Green Albert came from mainland Europe, or I guess it mostly came from the Dutch and the Germans in particular picked up on the whole idea. And then rather than doing even so much the sport that we were doing or the record breaking that the Americans were doing, they were just turning up with a trailer on the back with a dog and a crate of beer, and very nice. And their events in the early days were very much beer and sausages, which I recall with sort of, you know, great fondness, I think. Because, yeah, they were much more aware of what was going on. There was a lot more talk. But at the end of the day, they weren't taking anything away. They were just adding dimensions to the movement. The record breaking was and is still there. The sport is still very strong, but increasingly where they are at home is on the streets, touring, shopping, whatever sort of thing.
So we're 30 years on now from those days, but these machines have still not really caught on. They're still unusual sights. Why do you think that is?
Well, they have caught on because they're made in China, OK? They're made in China, they've caught on, OK? No denying it. They do not specialise there. No, because the Netherlands obviously is the natural home of them because of the cycle path network, and people don't feel intimidated. And I have to say, a laid-back cycle in the capital here isn't the best form of transport. I've just come from Liverpool Street on a nice little shopping bike, and that works fine. You don't need the performance or the comfort, the distances you're travelling in London. So this is not the place you're going to see them. So where I come from in Norfolk is where you're going to see them, because you want to do a 70, 80 mile ride in a day around Norfolk, which is not flat, but it is mercifully free of mountains, then a laid-back bicycle is absolutely perfect. And I think within the arena of the CTC, you know, the serious tourists, that's where they will eventually dominate, because they offer so many advantages and so few disadvantages. And the only real disadvantage in practice is very low speed stability and the wobbling in traffic. You know, you've got no body language, you're a bit sack of potatoes on the bike, but that's not something that touring is a big problem.
But you can't look over the hedgerows, you can't see above things, you're stuck down on the ground.
If that mattered, we'd be riding high wheelers still, I think you'll find. All the problems that go with them. No, it's true, you don't see quite as much as you did before, and as a birder I sometimes miss it, but no, it's they just are better for long distance comfort, slight performance, not necessarily, you know, double your speed obviously on touring laid back bicycle, but you do have a nicer ride. And of course you're not tempted to look at your front hub as you ride along, so they're inherently much safer. In fact, a friend ran into a car the other day and buried the chain ring in the car door, and it was its teeth, not his, that came out, which is what tends to happen if you hit a car on a classy bicycle.
Now, if Mike Burrows has whetted your appetite for looking at these wonderful machines, then this summer there's a fantastic opportunity to see the world's fastest bicycles and other human-powered vehicles just down the road in Kent. Mike explains more.
It's sort of our turn to run the world. We don't have to do it this year, but we thought with the Olympics are coming up, there's going to be a sort of sporting sort of feel, hopefully, to everybody. And we can get in just ahead of them. So June 8th, 9th and 10th, I think it is, we're down at Fellmead in Kent, which is just a couple of miles from Deal, near Dover. Very, very handy for the Continentals to come across. And there's a purpose-made bike track, a bit like the old Eastway, and again, dumped on top of an old slag heap, because cyclists get all the best places. Which is actually, like Eastway, greened up. Very nice these days. Very nice views over the countryside. It's a beautiful circuit. It's about 2 miles long, or two shorter circuits. Club room, you know, cafe, mountain bike hire, the whole lot sort of thing. So we're giving them a very nice venue. In the past, in this country and others, we've tended to look for rather more grandiose and bigger venues. The Italians ran it last year on Monza, the actual track there, which is quite nice, even the bit of the old track. The Dutch ran it the year before in Tilburg, using sort of bits of circuit all round town. But at the end of the day, none of them are. Monza's just much too bumpy for thin hard tyres. It's just fine with 600 horsepower, but a bit of a waste for us or whatever. Tilburg had too many sort of obstructions, like lifting bridges, that just like the ones in the Van Gogh paintings, that actually lift in the middle of the race, which was less than ideal, not to mention cobbles. So we're going to give them a really nice, smooth, fast, beautiful little road circuit, which is easy to manage, and we're camping next to the track, so we've got a nice little sort of social function there, sort of things. And I would argue that this is the cycling world championships, because everything else is then below that is then more defined. There are track champs and mountain bike champs and road champs. We are sort of, in a sense, universal. If I turned up at a UCI event, I would be too old and my bike would be too new, you know, whereas anyone from a UCI event is welcome to enter in our event. We don't insist on them being recumbent or anything. We just, it's human power and that's it. We have classes for, you know, streamlining and not streamlining, women's, juniors, whatever, and even a three-wheeler class. But it'll be a place to come if you want to see something interesting.
So a lot of people might think that they'll see the fastest cycling in the velodrome up at Stratford, or on the road in the road race, or the time trial in the Olympic events, but actually the fastest people on bikes will be down in Kent in June.
They will indeed. I mean, the ex-world champion is a Brit, he's a little Steve Slade. He's not much of an athlete to look at. He got quite a bit of toughness there. And he'll be riding a thing called Beano, which is sort of fully streamlined, two-wheeler, quite a nice sort of thing. And he just got beaten last year by a Frenchman, Aurelia Bonnetou, 2 metre tall, strong, fit Frenchman. But this circuit should suit him down to the ground, so you should see him topping 50, sort of coming down. There's a hint of it, not a steep hill, but there's a shallow gradient there, whatever, and he'll be whipping. Even though the straights are fairly short, he should be hitting 50 in there.
And what about the 100 mile an hour land speed record? Is that within reach? Is that possible? I mean, it's 20 miles an hour faster than the current record, right? The current record's around about 80, isn't it?
83. Well, it's interesting, the current sort of top they won last year, although they didn't break the 83 record, they did 80, is the Dutch Delft University team. And this is a very nice, the previous record, well, the record holder and previous winner is Georgi Georgiev from Vancouver Island, Canada. And George designs like I do. He's intuitive. In fact, he's a sculptor. I mean, he really does the Michelangelo bit. He sees the shape in the styrofoam, in his case, rather than the marble, and carves it out. No number crunching, no nothing. And he's been consistently, well, not, he doesn't ride, he's the designer. Sam Whittingham rides and has been the fastest. But this year, the Dutch team did it the other way. They sat down in front of their computer. The amount of time they spent on the screen optimizing the shape of this fairing, just phenomenal. And it was a modern computer package. It's really very good if you're trying to do aerodynamic design of a relatively simple shape. And the worst thing is a big square thing whizzing through the air. Obviously, it's high pressure at the front, low pressure at the back, big swirling, all sorts of vortexes. The best thing is a nice streamlined shape. But even once you've got a streamlined shape, there is a secondary consideration. And that's the state of the air running over the surface. And famously, yeah, they would polish Spitfires and things, whatever, and that gets you laminar flow. Now, laminar flow is, even today, sort of not absolutely understood. Basically, the surface needs to be smooth. You need to be going less than a certain speed, above about 200 mile an hour. It sort of doesn't really happen, but not much of it anyway. And the object needs to be getting bigger. So in other words, only the front half can ever be perfectly laminar. And even then it gets critical. And they did a lot of this optimization in the computer, then discovered that the wind tunnel gave them actually slightly different results, whatever sort of thing. And based on all the work they did, and they got 80 mile an hour with quite a good rider in, the theoretical potential might be there for 100. I wouldn't be, if you tip it on simple numbers, then probably no, because as I say, this thing of the as you increase your speed, the energy required goes up by the cube. So at this level, obviously, the tire drag goes up as well. That's the other thing, because it's linear. By the time you're going that fast, your rolling resistance is getting quite high. Interesting, the optimization showed them that they got this complete fairing, the 2 meter tall Dutchman inside it. They doubled the drag when they put the wheels on. There's half an inch of tire sticks out the bottom. Doubled the drag. Aerodynamic drag is doubled by half an inch of tire sticking out a little hole in the bottom. It's that crucial. So I don't personally think we will ever see 100 mile an hour, but it might just be theoretically possible.
Is it fair to say that classic bike racing, the Tour de France, the Olympics, have got inferior bicycles? The human-powered vehicle movement has got inferior riders. And if you combine the best athletes from the classic bike racing scene with the best of what you're producing, you might make 100 miles an hour.
No. No, it's the numbers. As an engineer, you need to know a bit about the engine, as an horrible a subject as it is, whatever. And what you discover is that if you take a healthy, fit 20-something and measure their power output, it'll be X, and that'll give you maybe 30 mile an hour on your Trek road bike. If you train as hard as you can and efficiently, you'll improve your power output by around 25%. That's it. If you choose your parents carefully and become an Olympic athlete, then you've got the potential for basically doubling your power output. Okay? We've obviously already got quite good riders. They're not Olympic winners, but they're quite good. So they're probably within 10% of an Olympic best. That's this fastest man in the world, the runner guy, whatever. Now, you know, he's only 1% better than the other guys in that race. That's the point. The differences become quite small. You know, we overvalue the winners, and it's the same thing. We're just not too far from the City of London, where the winners there give themselves 100 times more wages than the losers, despite the fact that they're only 1% better. They can only be that much better. No one could be twice as clever as the average person any more than can be twice as strong, sort of thing. But so it's all there. So we can have much more gains by engineering design than you can by increasing the power output from the human being. Just not, and even the chemists don't do much for you either, I have to say. It's engineers every time.
And would you like to see human powered vehicles in the Olympics? The fastest people on the planet with their own power in the Olympics?
No, because I really don't like the Olympics. The principle is brilliant. It's absolutely fantastic. The practice, no, is so appallingly bad. You know, everything about the Olympics in terms of running it and doing it and everything is so awful that it just defeats the object of the exercise in the first place. There's no harmony, there's no athletes meeting, there's no nothing of what it should be ever happens at the Olympics. It can't do it because it's just a great corporate, ghastly mess sort of thing. It's just terrible. It's a dreadful, dreadful thing. And they would destroy our sport. I mean, even the UCI recognising us would be bad enough. You know, we don't want to be recognised. We're fine on our own, thank you very much. You know, mountain biking was before they recognised it, sort of thing. Big organisations wreck everything.
You were saying earlier that you felt that the human-powered vehicles have a lot to do in terms of improving the image of the bicycle. If nobody's seeing what you're doing, because it's not part of a bigger thing like the Olympics or like the UCI, it's not on TV, how are you going to make that contribution to improving the image of the bicycle, which you say you want to do?
Yes, it would help. That's what I'm saying, it would definitely help. But not us. It wouldn't help the HPV movement. You know, we've got this really nice, friendly, sort of fun organisation, and we are enjoying ourselves. You know, we've got some rules that sort of work, and we're not that bothered if we sort of, you know, they slip a little bit here and there. But, you know, yes, if the UCI recognised it and we had... You'd have something like the prologues, maybe the time trials and the big tours using... Not fully fared. You don't want the fully fared. You don't see your heroes. Of course, you want to see your heroes. So the part fared with a little tail fairing and very low to the ground. And something like the kilometre, the old Velodrome kilometre event, which they'd sadly taken out of the Olympics. Nice specialised event for equipment. If you had the kilometre allowing laid-back cycling, as it were, sort of thing, then you'd see this interesting development. And it wouldn't necessarily win straight away. The kilometre is such a short event, and the start is so important, sort of thing, you might well find it'd be a job to beat the traditional bicycle with a laid-back whatever. But that would be the interesting thing. That's the point of it. You should encourage this where they're appropriate. You know, not anarchy, correct rules, to encourage cycle sport and to encourage then cycling outside of cycle sport. There's nothing wrong with the diamond frame safety bicycle. It functions incredibly well, whatever. It just needs more people on it. And the way you get more people on it, in the same way you got more people driving Mondeos, by winning rallies and Formula One things with Ford badges on them, sort of thing. You know, these people sitting in their car in a traffic jam, you know, they've got the Jeremy Clarkson image firmly in their brain, whatever, that they're doing something exciting. Now, we need to try and do something of that into cycling, to sell the image of cycling as... by its nature exciting and dynamic and technical. We know it is a cyclist. We know Shimano do these fantastic electronic gears, which are to die for, and all these other whizzy bits and the carbon fibre and the titanium and that. You don't see that on the pictures in the Sunday papers. You don't see that on the sports page. You just see bicycle. Yeah, man on a bicycle, whatever, just like it was last year and the year before for the last 100 years. And that's, in marketing terms, is death.
That was Mike Burrows, and you can find out more information about the human-powered vehicle world championships by following the link on the Bike Show website, www.thebikeshow.net. And those championships are taking place at the Foulmead Country Park in Deal, Kent, down there on the coast, on the 8th, 9th and 10th of June 2012. I think I'm going to go down and take a look. Sounds really exciting. Now, I love the London Marathon. It's one of my favourite days of the year, and I always make a point, if I'm in London, of going over to the course to cheer on the runners as they go past. And it's such a fantastic event. There's 36,000 people, and I was at the 22-mile mark, which is just by Blackfriars Bridge, and that is one of the most difficult moments for marathon runners. 22 miles, they're really feeling the pain, and they've got still 4 more miles to go. And it made me think, you don't see that kind of commitment, you don't see that kind of desire and drive to try a little bit harder at a cycle sportive. It's all too easy, too leisurely. And I wondered, what would it be in the cycling world that would be the equivalent of a marathon, a mass participation event that was a genuine athletic achievement? This started a little bit of a Twitter discussion yesterday evening, and someone who's followed up on that is Simon Nurse in Cardiff, who writes the Cycle Stuff blog. Simon, welcome to the Bike Show.
Hi.
You've done these different kinds of events. You've done marathons, sportives, Ironman. Would you agree with me that there's something special about the marathon?
Definitely, absolutely. I think 2 million years of human evolution hasn't caught up with about 100 years of tarmac. And there's something supremely brutal about running a road marathon, and a road marathon in particular. They are very, very tough things, no matter where you are in that sporting spectrum, whether you're right at the front or right at the back.
But for cycling, I don't know that I can think of the equivalent in a mass participation event. Somebody tweeted last night that there's an event in Sweden that is that goes for 300 kilometres and about 23,000 people take part. Do you know that event?
I don't know that event, but a 300k event, you're looking at about 180 miles, I guess, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I would say that's a pretty good approximation for the sort of efforts required to complete a marathon. The Tour of Flanders, which I think is another good benchmark, you know, sort of 165 miles, 35 miles of which are on cobbles. That gives you a true sense of a distance, difficulty, and abuse, which is something that the road marathon, when you're running, almost uniquely gives out.
Because the London to Brighton, a few people said, oh, we've got the London to Brighton, and that certainly is a big mass participation cycling event, but it's 55 miles. It's, you know, of course, it's going to be difficult, and you know, if you've not ridden a bike much before, that ride up Ditchling Beacon is going to hurt, but nothing like the marathon, is it really?
Absolutely not. No, I mean, you know, 55 miles is a decent ride. I've no doubt there'll be a few sort of hills involved, and you've got to train and prepare for it properly. But where the road marathon as a runner really differs from any type of cycling event is that you take that abuse every time you pound your foot down. And like spinning cranks, which thankfully most of the time on a bike is quite a kind of pleasurable experience. You know, notwithstanding hills and cobbles and bobbly bits. I noticed in that Twitter conversation that somebody suggested roughly sort of four times the effort in terms of...
Or a bicycle is four times more efficient, so therefore you should be maybe riding for four times longer?
I don't know.
It's just a different intensity, isn't it, really?
It's totally different. And you are comparing sort of apples and pears, really. They're completely different disciplines. I really don't think anything approximates the damage that you get from pounding the pavement. And, you know, it doesn't matter how sophisticated your trainers are. They've got to absorb an awful lot of shock, something that you don't really feel on the bike unless you're a continental rider regularly hitting the cobbles. I mean, I think that's a slightly different thing.
And there's something terrific, though, about the marathon, the way you've got at the front, you've got people setting world records, possibly trying to qualify for the Olympics, and then you've got a lot of club runners who are, you know, pretty good runners, but they're just amateurs. And then at the back, you've got people who are just having a go for the first time, and then obviously all the people in fancy dress, and the whole of London turning out to cheer them on.
It's a unique shared experience because the preparation you put into a marathon like that, as I said before, it doesn't really matter if you're at the front of the field or the back of the field. You've got to do the miles. You've got to commit an awful lot of time and an awful huge amount of your life towards this one day. And so many things can go wrong on that day. You know, it's a real achievement to be toeing the start line.
And what sort of commitment are we talking about in terms of training and preparation for a running marathon on the road?
Well, I guess it depends what your aspirations are. But if you're preparing for a marathon, personally, I would feel uncomfortable going into a marathon race. And I hasten to add, I've done a few marathons. I've got no real intentions of going back and doing them again. But were I to prepare for one in, say, 3 or 4 months' time, I'd be looking to get up to about 20, 22 miles in my long runs and looking to be doing mileage-wise kind of 50 miles a week is the minimum.
And so how many hours of running is that a week?
Ooh, that's a very good question. I didn't really measure it when I was training in...
When you're training for a cycling event, do you feel like, this is nice, this is easy training compared to when you're training for a running event?
Yes. Yes, completely. It's a different thing. I mean, what you tend to find is that when you go out on a bike ride, you can keep yourself fueled. As long as you keep eating, you're going to keep your energy systems going. And you come back, and it's a different type of tiredness. It's almost like the energy is being sucked and drawn out of you. Whereas when you're running long distance, you have that feeling, but you also feel a bit battered and bruised. And you need the recovery time of running that you don't really need with cycling. Cycling, you pretty much get up the next day and do it all over again.
So you mentioned the Tour of Flanders. I've mentioned this Swedish event that I can't pronounce or forgotten the name of, but I'll put a link to it on the website. Does any other event come to mind? There's going to be this London cycling event next year, which I think is going to be about 100 miles, and they're hoping for 25,000 or so people. Can you think of any other events that match or even come close to the London Marathon in terms of the overall experience for a cyclist?
I think, to be honest, as it stands in the UK, there are absolutely loads of fantastic sporties around, which is really good news for cycling in Britain. But I think for that type of experience and the sort of energy that comes into the event from the sidelines, as you mentioned, you're standing there 22 miles, you get that on the continent. I would say the Paris-Roubaix sportif, Tour of Flanders in particular, and there's one or two in Germany that are particularly good. But really, you're going to get that warmth from the crowds and the shared experience and the numbers and the difficulty on the continent.
Well, Simon, thanks for contributing your thoughts. And if people want to read your blog, what's the URL?
It's cyclestuff.wordpress.com.
Great. Thanks very much. Cheerio.
Cheers. Bye.
Well, we are approaching the end of this week's bike show, and just time for me to say, if you're in London next weekend, next Saturday, then there's only one place to be. It's on the London Cycling Campaign's Big Ride. That's a ride that's taking place in the West End and around Whitehall and Westminster to show the politicians, and particularly the mayoral candidates, but the politicians more widely in Westminster, that cyclists want a better deal from their politicians. They want safer roads, more pleasant cycling,
and, you know, a fair crack of the whip when it comes to government policy. So we'll be organising a feeder ride, a short feeder ride to the big ride for Bike Show listeners if we want to ride in a Bike Show peloton. And there are details for that on the Bike Show website and also on the Facebook page, which is a new Bike Show innovation. I'm not quite sure that I understand how Facebook works, but we have got a Facebook page and I am posting to it from time to time. Thanks very much for listening and see you on the big ride next weekend. Until then, bye-bye.